This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
This week, we have the Golden Globe nominations and the Critics' Choice Award nominations. It's been a busy couple weeks for things getting nominated, but these are just two large televised award ceremonies that come before the Oscars and have a whole slew of names on all of their lineups. So we'll talk about those, and then we'll talk about a little movie called Avatar: The Way of Water, which is out this week. By the time you listen to it, it might have made $1 billion. The future is really, the sky is really the limit on that one. But let's talk about the Globes and the Critics' Choice Awards. As we record this, the Critics' Choice are the newest ones. And as usual, the Globes and Critics' Choice have a fair bit of overlap. I mean, I think you see the favorites that we've been talking about over and over again, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, Banshees of Inisherin, Fabelmans, all performing really well. But maybe start with the surprise of the morning for me and for the Globes as well, is that Babylon is really hanging in there, even after some kind of mixed response from those early screenings that you guys have been talking about. Am I the only one who was kind of like, wow, good for you, Babylon, this morning?
I don't know if I felt good for you, but it certainly felt like, okay, you know, this is a movie that is big enough and star-packed enough and about Hollywood enough and made with, you know, cinematography and a big score and all that. Like, it was probably going to register at a certain point. You know, it might not be the critical darling of the season, but like, I mean, the Critics' Choice Award are critics, technically, but like, you know, in terms of the Globes, that's a different kind of awards body. And I would assume that Babylon will work similarly well on at least a segment of the Academy.
I was thinking about this late last night because I know we're going to kind of figure out our own top 10 picks. And I think it's going to make it into the Academy's Best Picture. Mm-hmm. I really, the more I thought about it, I feel like a lot of people are going to reward it for its effort. Yes, there are things that don't work, but I'm not surprised with the Critics' Choice nominations, and I feel like we have to take it more seriously as an actual Best Picture nom.
Yeah, I both agree with you, and I think that what we've seen doesn't necessarily say too much. The Critics' Choice nominated 11 movies for Best Picture.
Why limit yourself, David?
10 directors, which Damon Chazelle did make that cut. And then over in the Globes, it did have slightly easier terrain of competing in the comedy categories. But also, since our last recording, AFI came out. It didn't make that 10. They're pretty good with overlap with the Oscars Best Picture lineup. They usually only miss one or two American movies at most. Last year, they missed zero. So, you know, I don't think it's locked in or anything, but we really are talking about 12, 13 movies at this point fighting for one of those 10 spots, I think. And it's in that, you know, back half, but yeah, it's very clearly there. And that's my takeaway from at least these two award shows and what they said about Babylon.
I think that's been my takeaway, too, somewhat less surprisingly, for Top Gun Maverick, which won the NBR Award for Top Film of the Year. I honestly can't even remember if we recorded before or after that happened last week. It was on the AFI Top 10 as well, and then it's kind of shown up all over the Globes as well as the Critics' Choice Awards. I felt pretty confident that it was going to get into a Best Picture 10, but, you know, it gets 6 Critics' Choice nominations. Tom Cruise gets a Best Actor nomination, even though he didn't at the Globes. It's the giant movie of the year, save Avatar, I think is going to be in there pretty solidly.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, Cruise is also getting this PGA honor that was announced last week as well. So I just feel like And I was at an event last night, and a couple of people were very sure it could even win Best Picture. So I definitely feel like that movie is going to do really well as we move forward here.
And the door has now been opened, you know, and sometimes that's what it takes.
Yes.
You know, permission has been given that the Academy will not be scoffed at if they nominate certain people or certain movies, because other awards bodies have done the same. And I think that that always is a big deal for a campaign, even if ultimately the particular award shows, we have no idea what stature the Golden Globes is going to have this year. Like, I saw people remarking upon the fact that, like, very few emails from publicists saying, this is my client's reaction to their nomination went out on Golden Globes nomination morning.
Almost none. Like, Almost none. I'm still kind of stunned by how silent that was. Yeah.
But even so, it's on a website, it's on Twitter that such and such movie, such and such actor were nominated for one of these two things or both of these things, and that that paves the way.
Yeah, David and Rebecca, you guys kind of wrote up the question of, is the Golden Globes comeback real, and mentioned that lack of response from reps, even though there were, you know, people like Viola Davis kind of put thank yous or, you know, notices on the social media. A few days after that, does the Golden Globes comeback feel real?
I mean, stars tweeting out they were nominated for something, they'll do that for, like, a regional critics award. I don't think it's that
the Oklahoma Critic Association. Yeah.
No offense to the Oklahoma film critics.
Absolutely no offense. Honestly, I would love for Viola Davis to cite her impending Oklahoma Critics nomination. Now, it's not the same. And you cannot deny that there's a huge difference from the way that those nominations were treated 3 years ago versus now. It's just not the same at all. Even in LA, you quite literally could not watch the nominations live stream, which is a big shift, honestly.
And yeah, NBC, because they air live on the Today Show on the East Coast, but on the West Coast, it was 5:30 in the morning.
But NBC controls that. NBC has a 1-year contract. I don't know that that's the best show of faith. They didn't make it much of an event. They didn't make it a national event, period. And to Richard's point, though, I don't think that means the nominations are meaningless, and that's where the divide is this group has always been weirdly reasonably good at, you know, matching Academy tastes, minus their very notable outliers, which happen every year, and I think also happened this year, and that seemed to be true, because their tastes, clearly, with the expansion of membership, didn't change that much. They maybe got a little less insane, which is good for them. Maybe not as fun for us. But I don't know. I mean, we'll see who goes. I think plenty of nominees will go. I think more nominees than usual will not go. It could be a more similar turnout to what we see for Critics' Choice Awards.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good comparison, I think. Because Critics' Choice gets most everybody, but not necessarily everybody.
And Critics' Choice will be on a Sunday, right? And the Golden Globes are on a Tuesday.
Yes, the Golden Globes are on the Tuesday before Critics' Choice, so they get to go first, but Critics' Choice has more of the traditional, you know, Sunday night award show slot.
Yeah. The last thing I would say is I felt like with the Golden Globes, what they didn't recognize, it helped the movies that they did not recognize almost more than what they did recognize in some ways. It's a good boost of visibility for Daniel Deadwyler when everyone's like, why didn't they nominate Daniel Deadwyler? Because the Globes have no overlap with the Academy. It doesn't actually say anything about what the Academy's thinking, except maybe there's not enough visibility for that movie. And in some ways, a snub helps with that more. And same for, you know, the women-directed movies, Women Talking, The Woman King. It reminded me a little bit of when Little Women was snubbed by the Globes. And more of a groundswell around that movie did develop after that. It was obviously widely critically acclaimed, but it ended up doing really well at the Oscars with 6 nominations. And it seemed like the real campaign started when the Globes, ironically, did not treat it very well. So those kinds of things can actually help in a weird way.
Although, do you not see it also as a huge boon to Ana de Armas and Blonde for getting that Globe nomination? I don't know that it makes her like likely to be an Oscar nomination, but that's a boost in visibility, too.
that's so Globesy, though. I mean,
it's very Globesy. That's Globes gonna Globe.
It maybe even cruelly keeps the flame alive when it shouldn't be. Like, it should have been gently snuffed out, and like now there's like that Dumb and Dumber. So you're saying there's a chance? I don't know if there is. I'm curious about the Globes being on a Tuesday night. So the plan is it's going to be during commercial breaks of The Voice, right? They're just going to dash out a few awards before they have to
Blake
go back.
Blake Shelton is actually the shadow host of this award.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Women in Film released a statement after the Globes noms came out about there being no female directors and sort of how much work there still is to do, because I think that's exactly what you're saying, David, is, you know, while the Globes may not matter so much, I think people who are voters of the Academy go, oh, yeah, that would be kind of shitty if there were no women in this field, and maybe pay a little more attention to the very deserving female directors that are in this race. So I think that's a really good point, that maybe it is the ones that miss that might get the attention that they deserve and haven't been. I do think the Globes and the HFPA have shifted like at least one degree less nuts, because I was like, Julia Roberts, where you're coming from, Ticket to Paradise or Harry Styles, like I expect to see you. And so they've at least stepped like one step to the right of away from crazy. But yeah, I mean, we still saw a lot of those sort of showy nominations. So I think it'll be a question of who shows up. There's a lot, it feels like there's still a lot of wait and see, like no one wants to be the first person to release a glowing acceptance statement. So I think, you know, we don't have much longer to wait. And David and I think we'll get a better feel for it being in the room.
Mm. The female director thing, I think Gina Prince-Bythewood would be the one who I would maybe see to show up in there, because we talk all the time about how the director categories go for like huge, big spectacle, and the Globes director lineup. The Globes director line, if you got James Cameron, The Daniels, Baz Luhrmann, Martin McDonagh, a little, you know, less on the spectacle side of things, but that movie's so beloved, and then Steven Spielberg, like, it's, we've had women in the Best Director Oscar lineup the past 2 years. I would like to keep that streak going, but, like, I don't think that it is some crazy sexist oversight that it's not happening. Like, the competition and the field is just different this year.
Oh, I don't disagree. And actually, to that Little Women example, it's not like the Oscars nominated Greta Gerwig for Best Director, yeah. But I think it helps the overall visibility of the movies.
Sure.
And it keeps them in the conversation in a sort of backwards, ironic way. But I agree with you. And, you know, regardless of merit, I mean, I would put Sarah Pauly in my personal lineup. I think what she does with that movie is really special. But I also think that regardless of who directed Women Talking, although it is called Women Talking, but whoever directed that movie, it is not of the kind of style that typically the director's branch goes for. So I think that we always have said that that was going to be more of an uphill climb than others have said, maybe. So that's not a surprise to me. I guess we should talk about The Woman King missing Critics' Choice, because they nominated 11 movies, and that was not one of them.
Although Gina Prince-Bythewood did make it in the 10 director field, which is really something. That is odd. I mean, RRR made it into the Critics' Choice 11, which I would not have seen coming. But I think we've said a few times that movie just kind of keeps chugging along. That's a shame. It feels like it belongs with all of these other spectacles.
Yeah, I think the one area where the Critics' Choice are really useful is they do nominate, you know, they do all the craft categories. And so they nominated Nightmare Alley, but then you also saw it had a lot of, you know, craft nominations. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by The Woman King not really getting any outside of costume design. And that feels like something that could repeat as the industry starts weighing in a negative way for its chances to crack Best Picture, because movies like Babylon and Avatar and Elvis are really doing well below the line, and will do really well below the line, and that helps their chances of getting into Best Picture, as it did with, say, Nightmare Alley. So that was definitely something I noticed.
Well, here's where I get to the frustration, where The Woman King, as you watch it, you can feel that it is a movie that deserves to be much bigger than it is and is working with a smaller budget and COVID delays and all this stuff. And you see Babylon, which seems to have had just like a vault of gold bars to throw at whatever it wanted to do. And you see that difference in the awards nominations, too, which I think is really unfair, because what they managed to do with The Woman King with the resources they had is pretty spectacular.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
D, David, you mentioned how Critics' Choice nominate all the craft categories. They also nominate six actors per category. Although, you know, the Globes has the musical or comedy, too. So they tend to have a good number. So I don't know that it tells us a lot about, like, whether Austin Butler or Colin Farrell is pulling ahead because they're both in there. But I do think there are some people you can either say they are solidly in the conversation or they are solidly not.
Mine is Paul Mescal. The Critics' Choice Best Actor looks like a likely Best Actor Oscars
list, but someone's going to fall out. If there's six.
No, it's right. Minus Paul Mescal.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because that's the critical darling. And then the other five, Butler, Cruz, Farrell, Fraser, Nighy. Nighy was always kind of the, like, question marky fifth slot, I think. Maybe Cruz was more of that, actually. But now that, again, that road has been paved, I feel like he's got a good shot. And people seem to be watching Living and liking him in that. It's a great narrative. Older actor, beloved. You know, never been nominated before. So yeah, that does feel sort of interestingly sewn up. I'm also curious about Curtis and Stephanie Hsu both being nominated for Everything Everywhere. The big question is, like, well, two big questions have been, if Jamie Lee Curtis gets in, does that mean she wins? And does Stephanie Hsu get in at all? Which, you know, arguably she had, she does have the bigger role, the more complicated role, because she's kind of playing two characters. And there was some worry that she wouldn't be recognized for that. And so far, so good, it looks like.
Yeah, I kind of think they did Women Talking a favor here. Because the Globe snubbed both of them, Claire Foy and Jessie Buckley. And Jessie Buckley has emerged with Critics Awards and is kind of the one who's edging Claire Foy out, the clearer play. And them nominating her here and not Claire Foy, I think makes clear that she's their best shot of getting an acting nomination at this point. I think that movie's just so dispersed that it's quite difficult to settle on a favorite.
Yeah.
But I think they have one to more clearly campaign right now, if they so choose. With Everything Everywhere, I think it is a bit of a problem for Stephanie Hsu that Jamie Lee Curtis is, to my mind, very clearly in at this point. She's gotten in everywhere. She's actually done better in the Critics Awards than Stephanie Hsu. The Globes did not nominate Stephanie Hsu, which is not a huge surprise. But, you know, it's always tougher when there are two. And we saw with the Globes, they didn't nominate either of the Fabelman supporting men. Both of them made it in with the Critics' Choice. So it remains very confusing to me, like, with all these movies and these multiple contenders, like multiple very worthy contenders, who the Academy will actually push over the finish line, because it's not like either category is thin outside of those movies. And you're seeing in both of these nominations lists, those solo contenders like Angela Bassett and Brian Terry Henry, Janelle Monáe, pulling through over those, like, maybe more overall stronger contenders with more to work with in these categories.
But then also Barry Keoghan, who we worried so long would be overshadowed by Brendan Gleeson, who's really the co-lead of Banshees. He keeps getting in. I'm really excited for Barry.
I think Banshees is getting four acting nominations. That seems quite likely.
It would be the exact Power of the Dog lineup again, right? Two supporting actor.
I think that's what I said many months ago.
I know. I'm quoting you back at you, David.
I'm proud of that prediction.
Rebecca, I know you've been really on the worried about Stephanie Hsu train. Does Critics' Choice make you feel any better? Or are you still nervous?
It definitely, I think, helps her. But I mean, if you look at this group of six, right? I feel like we can call Angela Bassett a lock now. I feel like when that film first came out, we weren't sure, but it feels like she's just getting mentioned repeatedly and getting special honors and things like that. But I wasn't sure about Janelle Monáe. I guess I kind of was still viewing Glass Onion as sort of a question mark, but to me, it feels like if you had to predict one of these people not making it, I do worry that Hsu is going to be the one that's cut, which is a real shame. So I think it's a good step for her, but we just have to see what happens. You know, I think it's definitely an uphill climb still.
We should also add that Glass Onion got six Critics' Choice nominations. And, like, you can see why that group would go for Glass Onion. Like, Rian Johnson, member of Film Twitter, is going to be in the club there. So I don't know if that means that, Janelle Monáe got an edge in that way. Dolly DeLeon got that Globes nomination, which I think we should mention. They really went for Triangle of Sadness. And I don't know how many other groups are going to go for that, but unlike with Ana de Armas, where we're thinking maybe that conversation shouldn't continue, I really hope the Dolly DeLeon one does.
If nothing else, I hope Dolly De Leon has secured a spot on the White Lotus season 3 cast list.
Oh my God.
You know, she wouldn't have to play the exact same character at all. She could play whatever. But like, yeah. I just feel like he said he wants to film in Asia. Dolly De Leon's from the Philippines. Like, I don't know.
That, I want her to be like the rich, like, you know, Hong Kong studio executive on vacation or something like that. Sure. Like really just flip the role on its head.
But yeah, like I would love to see her in there. I don't know. The Jamie Lee Curtis narrative is still what's kind of captivating me because I'm just trying to imagine that speech. and like anecdotally on like Twitter, which I know, whatever, it's the Wild West, a horrible version of the, I mean, even worse version of the Wild West right now. But of the film people I follow and like the media people I follow, I saw so many people linking to, screenshotting, whatever, her Actors on Actors with Colin Farrell.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, it just seemed to really be making the rounds in a way that some of the others weren't quite as visible, which is intriguing to me because it seems like people are invested in that. And I wonder if, like, awards voting bodies are as invested in it as a sort of general public seem, or at least my little narrow view of the general public seems to be.
She's winning the Globe, right? Like, that's happening. I don't see how the HFPA would resist that.
The whole show will just be her speech because no one else is there. And...
Well, that's the question about the Globes in general, right? So we don't think it will necessarily be as heavily attended. Like, people aren't responding to the nomination the same way. But does a great Globe speech have the same weight that it used to? Like, I can't imagine people who are invested in this not tuning in to watch, even if they don't attend. And then seeing Jamie Lee Curtis's like all over the place speech, we hope, and saying, okay, yeah, she's due. That feels like that train can really start then and not stop.
Yeah,
we hope.
I feel like even if people don't tune in, voters don't tune in for the whole show. Those clips of the best speeches, especially something wild from like a Jamie Lee Curtis, will go around, and then that person is in the front of their mind. It still has some worth. Definitely to win that award, I think.
And like, could a Tom Cruise speech somewhere like either vault him into the front position or do a couch moment for him, you know, like, or could Colin Farrell give some lovely, thoughtful, lilting Irish, you know, kind of summation of career in a way? I know his profile has shifted since then, but if you remember during the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like, Brad Pitt was like really winning on speeches, you know.
Oh, definitely.
And both funny and reflective, and he chose reflective at the Oscars, funny at the Globes, and like, you know, I just think there is an art to that, certainly. And I feel like Colin Farrell would be good at it. Tom Cruise could potentially be good at it. Curtis, who knows, but it would be interesting. And you know, but that, I think that does start to count a little bit. Although I said that around Glenn Close time, and then that, look what happened.
I keep thinking of Jane Campion's speeches, which was like so charmingly batty. And then she had the, I think it was the SAG Awards, where she just called out Serena Williams. Yeah. And then whoever like sat Jane Campion down after that was like, listen, let's not do this. I hope that Jamie Lee Curtis is talking to that person and can keep it batty, but not looping in other celebrities for no reason. That was a stressful moment for all of us.
Yes, it was. The other interesting, I suppose, element of like how far Glass Onion can go is you have the SAG ensemble category, which is coming up. And I remain kind of a skeptic on that movie in terms of cracking the Best Picture 10. I feel like it's totally in it. It's in that 12-13 I mentioned. But, you know, AFI didn't list it, and that to me was more telling than Critics' Choice listing it, to exactly your point, Katie, about this being a movie made for them, or the Globes, again, putting it into comedy where it's a little bit easier to compete there, and they did not nominate Janelle Monáe. So SAG Ensemble feels like the next big hurdle for a lot of these movies, including like a Babylon, that are on the bubble.
How does Everything Everywhere All at Once not win the SAG Ensemble in a walk?
Like, how does it not win Best Picture? It's like, it's ahead right now.
It really
it's
is.
It's ahead. It's ahead.
I mean, The Fablemans keeps performing. Like, it, you know, it got, I think, the second most nominations, and it's not the kind of technical Marvel Everything Everywhere All at Once was, so you see why that tally would be different. I would absolutely assume Everything Everywhere All at Once gets more Oscar nominations than The Fablemans in the end. But you're right that it's ahead, and that's when we start to get nervous about something being too far ahead before all the award shows have started.
It's just, it's more fun to talk about a film that was an underdog at the start, right? Like, mm-hmm. The Fablemans felt so set up to lead this race, and that's not as fun to talk about. So I do feel like that energy and that excitement around Everything Everywhere is going to just keep helping it win and earn these nominations. And that cast is so charming. I don't know. It does feel like they could win. But then you'll talk to one person that's like, really, a movie with butt plugs is going to win the best picture? And you're like, I don't know what to tell you. So it's, I don't know. It's so interesting.
Well, Chariots of Fire won.
I want to talk about Best Actor because, Richard, you mentioned Colin Farrell giving a speech. Like, he gave a great Globe speech when he won for In Bruges 1,000 years ago. And I think I said this to David, that the way I see it, Austin Butler wins the Globe for drama, and then Colin Farrell wins for Banshees. I suppose it could be Brendan Fraser. The Whale is performing well at the box office when almost nothing else has. But I still just have this big question mark about Brendan Fraser. He's hanging in there, but Elvis and Banshees are both really well loved, and The Whale is not.
And they're not nominating Hong Chau.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of on his own. He's on an island with this movie, and yeah, with the Globes, are they going to vote for someone who has said he's not going to attend, who has described a pretty traumatic experience with a member of that voting body, former member of that voting body? And, you know, even if it's not a personal decision, you would want to vote for someone who is going to be there and will give you a great speech. So, yeah. You know, I don't expect him to win the Golden Globe, which isn't the end of the world.
He could very well win the Critics' Choice 5 days later.
Exactly. And I think that would be a big, you know, big hurdle for him, because the Critics' Choice is a big, you know, group, and being able to rally around that as a consensus in this category is important. But yeah, I do think that this is a pretty fluid category, and there's still a chance for another frontrunner to emerge.
And you guys have been saying for months that he was just going to win it in a walk, and I've been sitting here wondering if that was going to change. And
you have?
I'm not going to say that I'm right, because who knows what happens, but yeah.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, well, let's talk about a movie that performed very well with all the voting bodies we've been talking about, as well as the AFI Top 10 and the NBR Top 10. Avatar, The Way of Water is coming out this week. Richard, you've reviewed it. David and Rebecca, you've both been doing Q&As with the cast and crew, and James Cameron coming in remotely because he has COVID. But Richard, let's start with you with your review, because you had told me you liked it. I think in your review you expressed, like, some measure of hesitation, but they kind of ended with, like, it is a good thing for culture that these movies exist, which I'm going to say, I guess that was counted fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, I think so. I kind of kept deleting that little bit and then putting it back in, because it was kind of, it's a little joke. I mean, I don't know if, Avatar franchise is good for culture, but, like, it's better than a bunch of amorphous Marvel movies that have all started to bleed together in the cultural consciousness. Like, these are distinct things, not based on anything. And that's at least, you know, in these penurious times, would that feels something like different and good. The movie sat really well with me. I'll say, you know, when I saw it, I was fully immersed, didn't have to get up to go to the bathroom, was like really like locked in, while also sort of saying, okay, this is a lot of stuff about whales and, you know, what's the story here? And it turns out it really is a transitional movie. You know, it's much more of a setup for a sequel than the first one was. You know, the first one was a discrete story. It could have just ended there. We never go back to Pandora. Now we're in a position where, like, okay, we got to see the next installment, you know? And I that at first bothered me, but then I realized that I'm actually genuinely excited for the next one. And I just felt the way that I haven't felt at a big spectacular all year, you know, not even Top Gun, which I liked, but didn't transport me in the same way. So it was exciting. And I think that the people have figured out the motion cap. Like, it doesn't feel as stilted as it might have in the first one. There's a whole host of new characters, mostly the children of the Sully family, who acquit themselves well. And there's a lot about the kids, so people should prepare themselves for that. If they were just expecting, like, grown-up Na'vi doing things well, it's a lot of teens and younger kids doing stuff. But that kind of works because Cameron is making a sort of more, for all of the technological advancement, the storytelling is more old-fashioned, you know, and it was oftentimes in these big spectaculars that there would be a kid character, at least, who was sort of the eyes for the younger audiences. And I don't know, I liked all that sort of robust, old-fashioned epic stuff mixed with this technology that I'm still wary of, and yet makes a pretty strong case for itself here.
Yeah, I did a panel, and John Landau, the producer, was on it, and he was saying that after the first Avatar, they had sort of a post-mortem and with the entire crew and storytellers, and the one thing everyone said they hoped in the next one was for it to be a more emotional story, and I think they really pulled that off. I mean, maybe that's in part because a lot of them are more comfortable with the technology, but I fell for that story they were telling, even though I went in a little apprehensive about, do we need another one of these? But they won me.
You were like, really, you were like, oh my God, 3 hours. How, not to call you out here, but
I feel like I am.
Because I feel like I keep telling, you know, wanting to write off my opinion because like I finally remember the first Avatar. I was excited about this one. But I think your experience is more instructive for people who are like, did we really need another one of these? Because you really did not know if we needed another one.
Yeah. And it was the fastest 3 hours I think I've ever had in a movie. I just like, 10 minutes in, I was like, you got me. Like, this, it's just so stunning and so beautiful. And then the story is captivating. So, I mean, yes, there are moments of the dialogue that are a little cheesy, but I think, and the storyline is not the most original, but I do think it gives you what you want from a big blockbustery movie like this. So I agree. It really won me over.
There's a process to watching the movie where it starts and you're like, oh, yay, we're back. And then pretty shortly thereafter, you're like, oh, my God, there is a lot of exposition here, a lot of terms, a lot of mythology. And it starts to feel a bit silly, like you're playing a role-playing game or something like that. And then the third phase of that is that you just sort of start to admire Cameron's just bold conviction to all of this. Like, he really believes in it. He's really selling it hard, but not aggressively. You know, he just lets you get immersed in it, and then it really works. And so I think, I mean, it sounds insane to say, but if the first hour hasn't sold you, just wait for the next 2.25 and then you'll get hooked, or maybe you will, like I did. Rebecca, the emotional component really does work. You know, I felt by the end surprisingly invested in these characters, who most of whom we just met, you know, and also are hidden behind layers and layers and layers of computer graphics or whatever. But I really felt tense, fearing what I thought was going to happen, and then felt moved by what did, you know, and yeah. That's saying something.
Yeah, I just think that last hour, the big action sequence, basically the entire ending of the movie, just like the first one, but there's a lot of water stuff that will remind you of Titanic, maybe. And I think the emotional power of that, it is so visceral, even compared to the first one. Like, I just really can't imagine anyone who makes it to that part of the movie not being completely absorbed by it.
It's also interesting because I did a SAG Q&A, so I talked to the actors, and one element that came up a lot was actually how loose and liberating the process of acting in this movie felt, which is quite contrary to, as they said, like the experience of acting in most movies of this scale, because they described it kind of like theater, where they're actually not, you know, needing to worry about coverage or worry about, you know, hitting the right camera angle or doing a million takes, because they're basically, you know, bare bonesing it in black suits and whatever. But you can see just the, especially with Zoe Saldana, who I think is really amazing in this movie, the level of emotional commitment and intimacy between these actors and characters, it was kind of shocking to me. And I think there's a level of comfort that you didn't see in the first one between them. Probably just more comfort with the technology, with the process, you know, lessons learned from James Cameron, et cetera. And was really crucial to why this movie worked for me, because it sells it. it sells the emotional component, and that was not what I expected.
So what's the vibe been at these screenings you guys have been doing? Are all the SAG members, et cetera, sold as well?
So what was interesting about mine was that the focus, and maybe it was because James Cameron was on a little TV screen, but the focus was so much on him. And, you know, it was a screening full of actors. The majority of the panel were famous actors, Sigourney Weaver and Sam Worthington. But the adoration for him and the respect for him, because the movie had just ended, was very clear. And something I'm thinking about as we talk about the directing race, because, you know, Steven Spielberg, I think, remains the front runner there, but James Cameron's a real force, and he is going to get a lot of folks in his corner, I think, for what he pulled off here.
Yeah, I had sort of a opposite experience because my panel was the day that James Cameron tested positive, so he was going to be on until about 3 minutes before we took the stage, which was fine, but I did think it gave, obviously I had a million questions for him, but it gave, it allowed me to pay more attention to the response to each of the crafts. You know, we had costume design, cinematography, editing, all there. And the costume designer got a huge round of applause just in the middle of the panel. And it made me realize, like, it's going to clean up in crafts for sure. And it felt like there was a lot of them spent a lot of time just talking about James Cameron, but it's very clear how the insane amount of work they put in. I mean, the production designer made this water kingdom, like designed it in real world and in a miniature just to be created on a computer. You know, I mean, everything was made in real life. So it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we keep talking about Everything Everywhere and its pole position in Best Picture race, but I think it's a really different question in the director race. Not, you know, the Daniels really pulled out something amazing, but they're pretty new. This doesn't quite seem like the narrative is a place for them the way that it would be for Spielberg or Cameron. And David, I think you might be right that it might really come down to those two. And if you're in the director branch that like goes for The Revenant or something like that, which of those are you going to go for? I don't know. I see an edge there.
Yep. And just to zoom back a little bit to what someone was saying earlier, it is amazing how many like big movies we're talking about in this Oscar race. Like Avatar, obviously the Big Finish, but you know, the majority of the Best Picture lineup is probably going to be pretty large scale money making productions. And that's, I think, maybe a little contrary to the narrative that has been building, especially this fall, as these indies have struggled to find an audience, that there are good Oscar-contending movies that have found a lot of eyeballs, and that's nice.
It's really needed, don't you think? Like, it's been a rough box office year. The Oscars have had their own struggles. Like, that's kind of the best possible scenario. We haven't mentioned Nope because it got blanked by the Critics' Choice Awards, very annoyingly.
And the Globes, right?
Yeah, I think so. But I would say it's still very much a factor there. It made over $100 million domestic and would be yet another good point in that favor.
Mm-hmm. And it made AFI.
Yes, yeah. And don't forget, Kiki Palmer still out there in the hunt. If, you know, after we had her conversation with Angela Bassett, if they both get a supporting actress nomination, I would be thrilled.
What happens if Avatar somehow doesn't do well?
Richard,
oh,
don't.
Are we even entertaining that idea? And just
don't tempt fate.
I mean, I don't know. It's been 13 years, you know. I'm wondering, and the whole rap about the original movie was like, it's the biggest movie of all time that no one ever talks about anymore, you know, and
except Katie Rich.
Well, sure. Yeah.
I've been, you know, and they I've been did keeping that flame alive. Yeah, exactly.
And the re-release was really smart, you know, because it got it back in people's consciousness and people wrote about it and people saw it. And, you know, that counts for a lot. But like, I don't know. I know I said the same thing about Top Gun and I was so wrong. But like, and I don't have a feeling about Avatar. I'm just sort of curious about what that would say and what the future would look like if this movie somehow. And I'm not saying it tanks, but this cost a lot of money to make and market. And I'm just curious. I guess overseas, it'll do really well no matter what, right?
Yeah.
And has a huge China release, so it's kind of guaranteed to outperform almost everything just because it has that market and a lot of movies haven't.
Yeah.
So there's a way to spin it, I think, regardless.
And 3D ticket prices are back in play, right? So like,
do we pay
helps.
More for 3D again?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I need to look into this as I buy my ticket. Yeah, I mean, according to Deadline, it's looking like it'll make $525 million in its opening weekend. Global, not domestic.
That's more than they make in a year.
Barely, but yes.
Barely. Yeah,
that's crazy.
But the other thing about Avatar and Titanic 2 is that it's legs. Like, those movies both played because people went to see them over and over. They played through January. And I know that that's the play that they're going for this time. And Top Gun 2, you know, like, Top Gun did really well and wasn't a juggernaut until people just kept coming back to it. So,
well, yeah, nothing's opening huge. Like, Black Panther, which I don't really think is in the Best Picture conversation at this point, but it didn't open huge, but it, you know, had a great Thanksgiving weekend, and it's really had a great tail, and now it's, you know, definitely in that tier of it did really well, and Marvel can be very happy, and Disney can be very happy. You know, Elvis is another movie that opened strong, but the amount that it made was definitely based on how long it found an audience. Same with Everything Everywhere. And Top Gun, exactly. We know Babylon's tracking pretty well. I worked on a story with Natalie Jarvie where we got a little preview of the tracking there. And that, to me, feels like another one that may not open huge, but you hear about some of the sequences in that movie and you want to go back and see what you missed. That seems to be the new play for a lot of these movies, is sticking it out.
Yeah. Babylon, I have mixed feelings about, but I would be thrilled if it really made a lot of money, because I do think there's a lot of parts in that movie that you just got to see it for yourself. Kind of similar to Avatar. Like, go check it out. Don't rely on the buzz, because both of them will kind of surprise you in very different ways. So that does it for this week's show. We will be back next week for our last roundtable episode of the year, and we want to answer your questions. So please email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com. You can also find us on Twitter, which we'll talk about, but email might be the best way for us to keep track of it. If you're emailing Richard and Chris Murphy with your White Lotus theories, please just come over to us with your Oscar theories. We want those just as much as we want to know what Quentin is up to. As I said, you can find us on Twitter at HWD, and on our own, I am at Katie Rich, and Richard...
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield, 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs. And this week's award for the best reaction to Olivia Colman's Golden Globe nomination goes to Richard Lawson.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors, as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.